Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. We've got a lovely returning guest today. Who have we got, Alex?
Yeah, we have. And this kind of makes up for the fact that this is day five in a podcast marathon in which we are now losing the will to live. So we have Charlie White with us again today. Yay! She did a brilliant podcast on Marilyn Monroe a few weeks back and you all loved it. So instead of putting on her pub hat and taking the piss, which is what we do every week in the Mary Rose, she's come back to do some more Hollywood history with us. Hey, Charlie.
Hello. How are we?
Yeah, we're running on fumes now.
Oh god, yes.
Oh my goodness,
I am actually going to bake that Danish dream cake today that Nikolai told us about, just so I can shove cake in my face.
Oh, can you send me some, because I think I'm going to end up in bed after all of this.
No,
cake is never a bad thing, guys. Just keep going. No.
Cake is the answer to all woes. So, Charlie, we touched very briefly on this subject before, and we were like, wow, that should make a whole podcast. Yes. So tell everyone what we're going to talk about today.
Yes, I'm putting on my film student hat again and using my expensive degree to tell you all about the story of Clark Gable and Carol Lombard. And it's a real Hollywood story, 1930s, a lot of glamour.
This is going to be really good because my knowledge of Clark Gable is pretty much, I know he's in that last Marilyn Monroe film, and I know he's got a pencil moustache, and I know he says, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn, and that's about it.
Yeah, mine is exactly the same as Alex's, so I'm pretty looking forward to learning more about this.
Definitely. So, who was Clark Gable? Is that his real name? And what do we know about his early life?
Okay, well, it was part of his real name. He was born William Clark Gable on the 1st of February 1901 in Cadiz, Ohio. His father worked fitting pipes for oil rigs, which is all the sort of, it feels very Americana. And Clark helped him out for a while before realizing that that really wasn't the life for him. He spent most of his free time in the theatre, and by 17, he joined a travelling troupe of actors, and he was helping to build sets and doing the kind of small roles that were offered to him, you know, just getting by. But part of his travelling took him, you know, all over the country, and he met a lady called Josephine Dillon, who was a theatre manager. She took him on as an acting coach. She saw something in him. And at this point, it's interesting because Gable's story becomes remarkably like Marilyn Monroe's, only in a gender reverse role. Josephine Dillon took him under her wing. She paid to have his teeth fixed. She tamed his hair because he had really sticky out ears. And so she sort of tamed it long to grow and cover them a bit. She fed him up because he was really skinny. She trained his voice so it was a lower register and a bit more manly. Then she married him and took him to Hollywood.
I love this. Now you're acceptable and I will marry you.
Yes. I mean, I have to mention she was 17 years his senior. So this is an older woman taking the young ingenue under her wing. And it was her who got him to drop the William from the start of his name, and he became Clark Gable. We hear this story 100 times over with an older man taking on a young starlet. So it's really interesting to see it in the reverse with now Clark Gable.
You know what? That gives me a bit of hope that I could... Sorry, did I interrupt?
It doesn't matter. I was just going to say, it's pretty much grooming, isn't it? It's a bit creepy.
I was going to say, it gives a bit of hope that I could might date, not 17 years my junior, obviously, that's a bit out of the way, but, you know, could possibly date a younger man.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with that, girls, nothing at all.
Although, we are at the age now where, if they were 17 years our junior, they'd still be legal. And as my best friend from school is always keen on saying, if there's grass on the pitch, let's play.
Oh my god, really?
Yeah, mate, she is like home of, she was known to utter very loudly at Chelsea a great comment about the fact that she could still get in a size 12 if they were maternity pants and it would just be easy access for Eden Hazard.
Oh my goodness, this has gone in a whole different direction.
Yeah, let's go back to Clark Gable before we end up going way too far down this road. So she's groomed him and everything and taken him to Hollywood.
Yes.
What happens next?
Well, she's taken him to Hollywood in 1924, and really, he's not impressing anybody. Hollywood didn't see his appeal. He played the extra a few times, and some people say that there are films that if you squint and, you know, have a magnifying glass, you might see him in the background. But no, that was it. He left Hollywood with nothing.
That's kind of sad, really.
Do you know, sometimes you just got to try, haven't you? God loves a trier. But no, it wasn't Gable's time, and he left Hollywood shortly after.
Kelly Clarkson did that. No, seriously, she went to LA when she was like a teenager, was an extra in Two Things, and then her apartment burnt down, so she went back to Texas.
Oh my goodness.
So yeah.
God. Wow.
So where does Carole Lombard fall into the story?
Well, at the same time, about 1924, she was being signed up at the age of 16 to a contract at 20th Century Fox. She was doing really well. She was still using her given name, which was Alice Jane Peters. Her mother had moved her three children to LA from Indiana after she separated from their father. And Alice was a really sporty child and got spotted playing baseball at the age of 13 and was offered the role of in a silent movie, which she absolutely nailed. I mean, this is only in Hollywood stuff, right? She screen tested for Charlie Chaplin, and though she didn't get that particular role, she got a part in a Western called Hearts and Spurs, which was a massive hit and led to more Western roles for her.
Oh, it sounds terrible.
I know. Yeah, she was doing it. I mean, this is the thing with Hollywood. It is an industry, it's a machine. And at that time with the studios, if you've got something that's working, you just keep churning them out. So she'd been good in a Western. They kept making Westerns with her. She changed her name to the more exotic sounding Carole Lombard. But she got in an accident. At the age of 17, she was out on a date with some guy and their car crashed. She was in the passenger seat and shattered glass flew into the left side of her face. Not great when you're making a career out of your face. She was given emergency plastic surgery, but it left her face completely immobile for months and Fox dropped her. I mean, what are they going to do with this damaged starlet?
I don't know what to say. That's really, it's harsh. I can see why, but I kind of feel that her career, obviously her career doesn't go down the pan, but at this point I feel that, you know, that's the end, but it's not, is it?
It's not the end for her. We'll be coming back to Carole Lombard's story a little later, but this is dual narrative stuff because we've got the two of them both trying to make it in Hollywood against all the odds here. And we really need to get back to Clark Gable's story at this point.
Yeah, so how does he get back to Hollywood?
Hard work and tenacity. He went back on the road with his travelling troupe of actors and he became something of a local level matinee idol wherever he went. So, you know, he's a handsome guy. He wound up on stage in Texas and he caught the eye of a lady called Rhea Langham. She was a wealthy divorcee, again, 20 years his senior. Can you see where this is going? She became obsessed with him. He divorced Josephine Dillon, married Rhea Langham, and suddenly found himself with a completely unlimited amount of resources with which to have another crack at Hollywood. Rhea Langham was minted. She was really, really wealthy.
Call me cynical, but Clark, yeah. Come on, man.
You know, yeah, you could perhaps say, but in 1930, she financed a play for her husband to star in Hollywood called The Last Mile. And she arranged for the press to attend and he got good reviews. So, you know, fair play to him. He must have had some talent. So the good reviews turned into studio executives coming along and looking at him. And he very nearly got cast in Little Caesar at Warner Brothers. But Jack Warner hated the look of him. He said it was all the ears. He said he looked like a taxi cab with both its doors left open.
Oh, that's harsh, man.
Isn't it? It really is. But, you know, there's a lot of big studios in Hollywood and MGM were in need of leading men. They needed alpha men. They got plenty of old stars that they drafted in from the theatres and plenty of the kind of, shall we say, gamma types that you could take home to meet your nan. But what Louis B. Mayer saw in Clark Gable was a leading man with animal magnetism, rough and ready. This was the kind that he needed. He got cast as the man's man and the studio taught him how to hunt, how to fish, how to ride horses, all things that he'd never done before, but he did for publicity photos and then ended up loving.
This is when Carol comes back into the picture though, doesn't she?
Yes, it is. So roughly around this time, you know, the industry is changing. in Hollywood in so many ways. But the big thing is talking pictures, synchronized sound. Silent films just aren't going to cut it anymore. And studios needed actors who could do speaking roles. Carole Lombard had a great voice, so this is really, really good. She'd not been idle while Gable was making Waves. She'd recovered enough from her accident to be able to cover her scar with makeup and lighting. It's very hard to see it ever, I'll be honest with you. She'd worked with a comedy legend by the name of Max Sennett, and she learned the physicality of comedy, you know, slapstick, over-exaggeration, that kind of thing, and found it really suited her. She was naturally exuberant. She had a very funny character. So this was all kind of very natural to her. And when you pair this with her ability to speak lines, it made her a really hot property. And in 1930, when Clark Gable's coming in to do his play and getting seen, she was signed to Paramount Studios. They didn't really know what to do with her, so they lent into her glamour. And again, like I say, you really can't see the scar on her face. So if you're imagining some sort of Phantom of the Opera deal here, it's a tiny, tiny scar and covered with makeup. She starred in five films that were released in 1931, and two of them were opposite William Powell, who was going to become her first husband.
I like this. First husband? One of how many?
You can't just have one in Hollywood, can you?
No.
What's the magic number, by the way? Do we know?
No idea.
Liz Taylor had more husbands than Henry VIII had wives. So she did very well, Liz Taylor.
She did. So they both suffer heartache before they meet, don't they?
They do. I mean, you know, William Powell was quiet and refined, and Carole Lombard was not at all. He was 38 and she was 22, which is not, you know, it's not a ridiculous age gap. But when one partner wants to sit in and has kind of done all of the Hollywood party scene and the other one hasn't and wants to go out and drink and party, Carole Lombard could famously swear like a sailor, and she was not at all refined. So there's this big chasm between the two of them. Meanwhile, Clark Gable is making himself notorious at MGM for shagging his way through his leading ladies. He was physically incapable of refusing an actress if she offered him a go. And he had an affair with Joan Crawford, who he starred with a couple of times, but this was going too far for the studio because she was married to Douglas Fairbanks Jr. at the time. And that's Hollywood royalty, and you don't mess with that. So he gets sent over on loan to Paramount as a punishment. And it was there in 1932 that he starred opposite Carole Lombard for the only film they ever appeared in together, called No Man of Her Own.
Was it love at first sight?
No. Their working relationship was strictly professional. It was even friendly. She presented him with a ham that she'd had with his face on it for being such a hammy actor. I think it was bad timing, if I'm honest.
It's harsh, though, like if you're the only bird he won't sleep with.
Well, I think there was two reasons for it. One, he is being on best behaviour because he's just been sent off for having an affair with Joan Crawford. And Carole Lombard was actually married at the time. She divorced William Powell after just 2 years of marriage. They were completely incompatible, but they stayed friends and they worked together, but their marriage was done completely. Gable couldn't behave himself for long though. So after he's made the film with Carole Lombard and that's kind of done, he stars with Jean Harlow in Red Dust, which is this wonderfully pre-code romantic comedy. He's not shaved, she's not wearing a bra, you know, it's real kind of the stuff that would be banned for many, many years in Hollywood. And he had an affair with Jean Harlow, of course. He got himself loaned out again. Please, Clark
Gable. It's the same as like if you piss off your club at football. Like if you, yeah. Like the guy at Chelsea who bought an air rifle to training ended up loaned out to fucking Bradford or whatever.
Yeah. It's, do you know what? It really is. It's the ultimate way of punishing them. So they loaned him out to Columbia, but he landed on his feet there because he got a role in Frank Capra's It Happened One Night, which earned him his only Best Actor Oscar. So he did quite well out of that and simultaneously completely destroyed the undershirt industry in one scene. because he took off his shirt and he wasn't wearing an undershirt. So men decided, well, if Clark Gable's not wearing an undershirt and that's sexy, I'm going to be sexy like Clark Gable.
Just so. Briefly interlude on the fact that I kind of understand the not wearing a bra thing sounds so Hollywood, old Hollywood, uh-huh. and sort of judgmental and morally stupid. But the shaving thing, did people have to be clean shaven?
I don't think it wasn't a case of you have to be clean shaven, but when the Hays Code came in, one of the things that they were very explicit about was that the hero should be a hero. You should be able to tell who the good people were and who the bad people were, and the good people should be rewarded and the bad people should be punished. So having a hero who's kind of dirty, that sort of anti-hero type, became a bit of an anomaly during those years of the Hays Code. So yeah, it was very charged sexually, Red Dust. And those films of the early 30s are, some of them are really quite hot and really walking a very thin line between what would be appropriate later on and what we're used to seeing now. So,
and then the Fun Police came along.
The Fun Police did come along, unfortunately. But hey, you know, sometimes rules are a good thing because it made directors and writers be creative. So, you know, we got some great stuff out of the code. So I'm not knocking it completely. At this time, Carole Lombard was doing really well as well. So she's making a really big name for herself. She starred opposite John Barrymore, who is Drew Barrymore's granddad, I believe, in a film called 20th Century. And in that film, she basically invented the female lead in a screwball comedy and created this whole new niche for herself with an emphasis on clever dialogue, delivering it with humour and elements of physical comedy. So she was doing really well at this time as well.
When does it change from being not the right time to being the right time for these two?
We're still not there yet, guys. You know,
no
you
way.
You want the romance and you want it now, but I'm sorry, I've got more heartache for you.
Well, Alina will be happy because she's
history, so. Well, this is where it gets really dark.
I know Alina does dark well.
So now it gets dark on both sides. So Carole Lombard was in love with a crooner called Russ Colombo, who died in this freak accident when a friend was showing him a Civil War gun and it went off into Russ Colombo's head. I mean, this is just...
You say that, but my uncle did that in the Afghan War and ended up having to marry the guy's ugly sister as an apology.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
They had five kids. They were very happy, but the father was like, you have come to me, you've apologised, I can accept that it was an accident, but now you've got to take this ugly daughter off my hands.
Wow.
People, so it happens. Yeah. Be wary of guns. You may be marrying an ugly man or woman.
Don't play with firearms is the moral of the story.
Not have guns in the house. It's just a bad idea. So she mourned him for months. She really did love him. And some people say that, you know, if he'd lived, he would have been the love of her life. So yeah, she was really upset. Gable, again, what do you think he's up to? He's still fiddling around with his leading ladies. And he has an affair with an actress called Loretta Young, which takes a really sinister turn when she falls pregnant. Now, this is, again, studio system days. So she refused the abortion that was offered to her by the studio and took option B instead. And this was option B. She went away to have her baby in Missouri, giving the child up to a local orphanage under an agreement that she could return and stage a fake adoption. I mean, this is Machiavelli kind of level of stuff. 20 months later, Hollywood star Loretta Young visited an orphanage in Missouri and was so moved that she adopted a girl on the spot, her own daughter. The girl grew up and was named Judy Lewis. She became an actress and she didn't find out who her father was until she was 31 and her father was dead. Her mother admitted the truth to her after, you know, because there'd been rumours, it'd been a long-standing rumour. And she said, you know, come on, tell me, is this true? Is Clark Gable my father? And Loretta Young replied, yes, you are my sin.
Oh, that's horrible.
Dark, isn't it? Absolutely incredible. But
too dark even for Alina.
Yeah, I mean, psychologically, God, that must have screwed her up.
Oh, she wrote a book about it, actually. I've not read it, but yeah, I mean, I can't. I mean, if you look at her, she apparently, as a child, she had her ears surgically pinned back You could tell she's Clark Gable's daughter. She's got
just like so the extra slap in the face. I don't know who my dad is, but he gave me these ears.
Bless her heart. Yeah, but you know, this is how the studios worked. They had to protect their stars and the perceived morality of their stars at all costs. And you can't have an unwed pregnant star, and you certainly can't have her unwed and pregnant by a married leading actor. This is just not going to happen.
I mean, Hollywood's still massively hypocritical, isn't it? It's just in different ways now.
Yeah, I think they don't have quite the power that they have now. And also society's changed a lot. You know, if you weren't married and you got pregnant, you know, it's not the end of the world that it would be in the 1930s. But I'll give you some romance though, shall I? Should we lighten it up?
Let's do it.
Okay, so Gable and Lombard meet again in January 1936 at Hollywood's glittering Mayfair Ball. So just imagine the glitz and the glamour of 1936 Hollywood. It's gorgeous. They realised they'd got a lot in common and they hit it off. And he even loved her filthy mouth, which made itself famously apparent after a few drinks.
Yeah, I think Alina and I are still waiting for that bloke to come along, aren't we?
Oh, God, where is he? If you're listening... Where are you?
If you love a girl who swears like a sailor, get in touch.
Yeah, pretty much.
At history. They started having an affair. They had an affair in plain sight, really. They met in hotels, at friends' second homes. He would even sneak into her home by crawling in through the back garden. But they couldn't meet at his place because, hang on, wait, he's still married. The publicity department at MGM managed to keep the affair out of the public eye, and Carol Lombard did a great job of feeding the press loads of interviews and photo shoots. At this time, she was really in high demand. She'd renegotiated her contract at Paramount and became the highest paid actor in Hollywood by 1937. Now, that's not the highest paid actress for a girl, you know, oh, aren't you doing well? She was the highest paid actor of all of them in Hollywood.
That's amazing, because there's still a massive gender gap in Hollywood.
Yeah, huge. And plus, the idea of being, essentially, she was a freelancer, which didn't happen. She was in that much demand that she was able to renegotiate her contract, that she could work at any studio she chose. She had approval of director. She had approval of publicity, of cinematographer, of makeup and hair. She was really bossing it. This is remarkable. I mean, I can't stress enough how phenomenal this makes Carol Lombard as a human being at this time to have done that.
She really is bossing it, isn't she?
She is. And they were getting away with it as well, which is all good.
So they're happily boffing away, but sinister events are on the horizon, as in World War II. Should we quickly touch on what happened with the two actors in World War II?
Yeah, okay. So we need to say that before World War II, they did manage to get married. But the only way that they managed to get married was by Clark Gable doing a film he didn't want to do called Gone with the Wind. You might have heard of it. He did not want to do that film. But Louis B. Mayer said, I understand you need quite a lot of money and I will pay for your divorce. Because Rhea Langham's kind of gone, hang on, you've been screwing around on me for years. I'm not letting you get away easy.
Yeah, you owe me, rat bag.
You owe me big for years of humiliation. Anyway, did the film, got a bucket of cash, got divorced, and on the 29th of March 1939, Clark Gable and Carol Lombard were married. They moved into a ranch in Encino, California, and you know, everything looked perfect, but the marriage was having its problems, okay, because they'd got together with this whole clandestine thrill of love making in secret, and it turned out they really missed the element of danger when they got married. So they started booking hotel rooms under pseudonyms and shagging in public, you know, doing whatever you can to keep the spark alive. Not that Clark Gable ever experienced any problem getting his leg over without his wife, but that's another story. And then the war. So yes, the war happens, which is all very exciting, but Hollywood do not want to get involved in politics at all. Okay. At the beginning of the war, Hollywood was strictly, strictly neutral because Germany was a big customer and you don't upset big customers. However, Carol Lombard was amongst many in town who felt very differently, looking at global politics and felt that something had to be done. So she sought out a starring role in a film called To Be or Not to Be, which was Ernest Lubitsch's light black comedy with Nazis. It's fantastic. It's the story of a theatrical troupe in Poland who are confronted with the Nazi invasion. And it's a tale of acting, ego, vanity against the bigger global picture. It's so funny and so complex. And if anyone's going to look up any film following on from this, To Be or Not to Be from 1942, that's the film to watch.
I'm writing this down right now, by the way.
You'll love it, Alina. Lubitsch was a German exile, like many people who were working in Hollywood at the time, and felt very strongly about what he saw happening in Europe. But the reviews were really mixed because some people thought, actually, you can't satirize what's happening in Warsaw at the time. And Lubitsch responded and said, you know, what I've satirized here is the Nazis and their ridiculous ideology. I've also satirized the attitude of actors who remain actors regardless of how dangerous the situation may be, which I believe is a true observation. So it's fantastic. It is really, really, really worth watching. Hollywood eventually gets dragged into the war when America does, so after Pearl Harbor, and they decide the best way that they can help is by sending its stars out to raise money and support for the war effort. Carol Lombard became the best salesperson ever, of course, because she bosses everything, and she raised loads of money through speaking at rallies and selling war bonds to ordinary people who would part with their cash to have a look at her, really, to come and see her talk. On the 15th of January 1942, she appeared in her home state of Indiana, all wrapped in furs, beautiful, and she gave a rousing speech which earned $2 million for the war effort in one single day. When her work was done, she was in a big hurry to get home to her husband.
So what happens to Carol?
Okay, well, like I said, she's in a hurry to get home to Clark Gable. And there are two versions of this story at this point, but both involve his leading lady, Lana Turner. One story goes that Lombard suspected him of playing around and wanted to get home to keep tabs on him. The other is that they had had a blazing row in which Gable had refused to give his wife the satisfaction of denying that he was sleeping with Lana Turner before she left, which made her leave in the middle of a fight. That story then goes that they made up over the phone and that she wanted to hurry home to make up with him in person. So she was so desperate to get home from Indiana that she decided to fly rather than take the train as they'd planned. She got her mother with her, and her mother was terrified of flying. So Carol flipped a coin with her mother and she won. On the 16th of January, 1942, their plane crashed into the side of the Spring Mountains outside Las Vegas. There were 22 passengers, including 15 soldiers from the US Army on board, and no survivors. She was 33 years old when she died.
That's tragic. She's at like the height of her power and everything, isn't she?
She really was. It's just such a sad story. Eddie Mannix, who is MGM's Mr. Fix-It for stars who are in need of help, called Clark Gable to tell him that there'd been an accident, and both men travelled to the foot of the mountains. The crash site was completely inaccessible by car, so Mannix and a few others hiked up the side of the building while Clark Gable sat in the Pioneer Saloon, which is still there, and drank while waiting for some news.
It takes about 5 hours to get up to the crash site, doesn't it?
It does. It's an incredible, I'll share a link on Twitter so that you can actually see someone going up to the crash site. People still visit it today. It's an incredible thing. It's just twisted metal. So when the search party came back from that massive hike, they couldn't offer any kind of comfort to Clark Gable because they hadn't found anything much more than twisted metal. Mannix could only offer Clark Gable, the only thing he had found was a fragment of a ruby brooch that he'd given to his wife on their wedding day as evidence of her death, and that was it. So Clark Gable did what any grieving man would do. He fell apart completely, picked himself up and enlisted.
That's right. I mean, if you want, yeah, Yeah. Revenge on the war, go get it.
Exactly. For a lot of people, when they saw news of Carol Lombard's death, for a lot of Americans, that was the first indirect American civilian big name death of the war, because you know, she'd been traveling with servicemen. The reason they'd crashed into the mountains was probably because they weren't lit like they should have been properly lit, because everything's kind of blacked out. So she was a big death for them. But Clark Gable enlisted, like I say, and he enlisted as a private in the US Army Air Corps and went into officer training. So he didn't just jump in at the top because he was a big star.
How does World War II pan out for him?
Well, Major Clark Gable, he trained as a gunner and he flew on a few bombing raids. So he did actually see active service. But the army did have to stand him down after not too long, because he was Hitler's favourite actor. And there was
dubious accolade.
I know. Well, if you're going to have a favourite Hollywood actor, I can't blame the guy. He was Mr. Hollywood. But the army were very concerned, as you would be, that his presence was putting his unit at extra risk. They actually worried that Hitler might have wanted to capture Clark Gable and keep him on display or something like that. Imagine himself.
I just had to
put him in the Berlin Zoo.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, but after the war, Gable made some more movies, but he'd aged dramatically, as you imagine that he would have, you know, having lived through what he'd lived through. And someone said, which I thought was quite wise, that having really loved and really lost and gone through that, it must have been very hard for him to play at it, to play that lover on screen and play that he was in mortal danger when he had been in mortal danger, and it must have been very difficult for him. But he did keep working, and he stayed on the ranch. He stayed on their Encino ranch throughout two more marriages. He married twice more after Carol Lombard, until his death at the age of 59 in November 1960.
So he too was, one of his later roles was with Marilyn Monroe, wasn't it?
Yes, he died weeks after the rap of The Misfits with Marilyn Monroe. He'd done all of his own stunts in that film, despite having recovered from two heart attacks already. He was jumping on horses, jumping off horses, riding horses. It was very, very macho stunts that he did in that film. And he was adamant that he'd do them himself. And he died of a heart attack. So, yeah, probably not unsurprising, I would say.
He should have taken it easier, really. He might still be, well, not still be here now, but maybe a couple more
he'd
years.
Be 119.
He might have had a few more years, but hey, look, I mean, this is Clark Gable. He was the big man's man, the big actor on screen. I think he went out the way that he probably would have wanted to. Anyways, I don't think he would have wanted to sit in and be quiet. I don't know. Who knows? But his widow, Kay, she respected his wishes when he died, and his body was interred next to Carol Lombard's, and they remain side by side to this day.
It's got to be harsh if you're one of the later wives, hasn't it? You know, you're just the consolation prize.
It had to be difficult for them, because they were, in many ways, of a similar type. They were petite, blondes. They had a kind of Carol Lombard feel to them, if you like, in the way that they looked. So, but you know, hey, everyone's got a type. What are you going to do?
Just a bad copy, really.
Yeah, I mean, it can't be easy, because, like I say, they were clearly very in love, despite Clark Gable's behaviour. Maybe he would have stopped it, and maybe he wasn't having an affair with Lana Turner. He might not have been, and I quite like that idea that maybe she accused him of it and he just said, you know, I'm not I'm not saying anything. If you think I'm doing this, that's bad enough. I'm not going to justify this with an answer. But then,
wonder if it's a bit like Edward the Seventh, whereby because he was such a slutbag at one point or many points, every woman he ever brushed up against gets added to the list.
I don't think you're far wrong in that. But then he did have previous, and she was right to be. She was right to be nervous and to suspect him. But
okay, so what do you think is their legacy as a couple in terms of Hollywood history?
I think their legacy is one of a, you know, they were the epitome of 1930s Hollywood glamour. She's the beloved comedienne. He's the ultimate manly leading man. They made sense. In fact, when news started to hit the press that they were having an affair, whereas you would have expected people to say, this is awful, this is adultery on his side, this is terrible, actually the public kind of went, yeah, I can see that, that's kind of cute. So they fit together really nicely. I don't know what their love affair would have been had she lived, but this incredible tragic end and his reaction to that is just really beautiful. This should be a movie in itself. I'm kind of furious that it's not.
Yeah, I can't believe it isn't. This is my point of reference for everything. Let's just hope it's better than The Crown. Well, this is not like people doing really over-the-top impressions of Carol Lombard and Clark Gable so that you just cringe all the way through it.
If there's one thing that Hollywood loves, it's films about itself. It loves it. I mean, if you know, this is Oscar-worthy stuff here. And plus, every time I look at George Clooney, I think, seriously, get this. He should have been playing Clark Gable years ago, really. We're pushing it now, bless him. I love him. But, you know, like I say, Clark Gable died at 59, so it's not like you can be an old Clark Gable. So I wish that they get it together. I don't know, maybe I should sit down and write it. But it's got everything. It's got sex, it's got glamour, it's got the war. Perfect.
Maybe for next week down the pub with the History's Greatest Love Affair, you should do Hollywood's Love Affair with itself.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. Hey, well, you know, this is why they've made A Star Is Born like four times. They love a film about themselves. So best film about Hollywood at this time is still Singing in the Rain. Perfect. About the transition to talking films. It's just perfect in every detail.
Charlie, thank you so much for joining us. That was so insightful. I absolutely love the story of Clark Gable and Carol Lombard. This kind of story that doesn't start at love at first sight, as you always would think so, but ends up a really sad but powerful story at the end. So thank you.
No, thank you for having me. As a wiser man than I said, the course of true love never did run smooth.
This is true. Or it never got started in my case, or Olivia's case. I think
everyone.
Yeah, I think you should take Singing in the Rain and perhaps come up with four more critical films in Hollywood history that show the development of the history of cinema, and we'll have to do that.
Yeah, no problem. So that'll be a joy.
Just don't pick The Patriot, because that just didn't go down with the greatest war film debate, although it was very funny.
Yeah, that was clearly a joke suggestion. No one likes The Patriot.
And yet still didn't come last.
Join us tomorrow when we will be talking all about notable assassinations in history, and that's with the Assassinations podcast, so don't miss out on that one. Don't forget that we do exist on Patreon as History Hack, and on Patreon as well, which is Podbean's own version. Alina and I have had massive fun doing this in 2020, but life's going to change quite a lot next year, and we're going to actually have to go and earn a living, etc. If we want to keep up the regularity that we've been bringing you and the kind of guests that we've been bringing you and the workload, then we will need your help. So if you join, there's going to be incentives for joining on either of those platforms. We're revamping ourselves on both of them, so don't forget to go in. You can do as little as $1 a month, and it all goes towards keeping up History Hack as regular as we've been able to bring it to you this year. Join us tomorrow when we will be talking all about notable assassinations in history. And that's with the Assassinations podcast, so don't miss out on that one.